Welcome to The Savage Truth with Cicely Davis. I am your host, Cicely Davis.
Fanny Willis. Oh, I just love saying that name because the case in itself, the whole entire story, gives me so much joy. It has been such a pleasure reporting on this fiasco known as Fanny Willis and her lover boy, Nathan Wade. I almost want to hold back and not give you the what's up on the story because once I do, it's kind of over. She'll disappear and it's just all over. Now, we knew this was coming, but, you know, it's just given me such joy. I've had so much fun reporting it. So we're going to start out by talking about Fanny Willis. But before we do that, I want to say welcome back, American Savages, to The Savage Truth. I am your host, Cicely Davis. Super excited, as always, genuinely excited, as always, to have you join me. Really appreciate those of you who have been with me since day one or in the very beginning, those faithful subscribers. I'm not interested in doing this without you. I really do truly, truly appreciate your support. For those of you who are new to the channel, welcome. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. Tell someone else about the show. Come on back next time. Bring somebody with you. Now, for the ride or dies, the loyalists, and for those of you who are new, I have an ask, and it is this: to please like, share, subscribe, and leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on YouTube. Please and thank you. And like I said, we're going to go ahead and move into the Habs. Fanny Willis! I just love saying that. I really, really enjoy saying her name. Fanny Willis, the prosecutor behind the Georgia election interference case, a bogus case, a ridiculous case, a case that should never have been brought in the first place, is the latest star in a long line of politically motivated legal crusaders. Except this time, she's the one who's getting a little too close to the flames of partisanship. Now, for someone who has been tasked with upholding the law, you'd think she'd be more careful about her political ties, but alas, here we are. Willis has a history of cozying up to the very political elite who have vested interests in ensuring the downfall of conservative leadership. She also has a history of cozying up to, you know, unqualified attorneys like her lover boy, Nathan Wade, but I digress. How convenient for her. How convenient. She might want to start taking notes from real public servants, you know, real public servants, you know, the ones who don't engage in courtroom theater to settle personal vendettas. Might want to take some notes there. Disqualifying her seems almost too easy at this point. We all know a partisan fox should never be left to guard the hen house. Now, I need to state that the charges have not been formally dismissed. Gotta say that. That being said, Georgia State's appeals court decision this last Thursday to boot Fanny Willis and her office muddies the path forward already complicated by Trump's imminent return to the White House. And believe me, hear me and hear me good, Donald Trump will be in office and doing so and swearing in on January 20th. Okay, make no mistakes about that. Do not doubt. Don't question. He will absolutely make it. The case itself, however, let's talk about the utterly baseless premise upon which it was built. Willis is chasing a crime that simply doesn't exist, hasn't existed. This was a bogus crime from the beginning because, spoiler alert, there was no election interference in Georgia in the beginning, just a bunch of loud Democrats dreaming up what-if scenarios. That was the basis of this entire case. If the goal was to find election tampering, she should have started by investigating the very people who set up the mail-in ballot fiasco from the beginning. But instead, she's gone on a fishing expedition, hoping to land some big political fish in a case designed more for drama than actual justice. I mean, these people need the fodder, right? They need the cases so that they can build their careers, so they can eventually work themselves up into office to go to Washington to waste our money and make a whole lot of money and do absolutely nothing for the American people. This is the pattern, okay? Let's be real. Let's be savagely truthful about that. Now, the truth is, this is less about enforcing the law and more about causing a shadow of doubt over the 2020 election, which, by the way, I don't know why that even matters because your boy Donald Trump is in. He's going to get in 2024 and 2025, January 20. Okay, so the focus on the 2020 election and the whole thing of trying to still conjure up this thing against Donald Trump is pretty much a waste of time. It's baseless. It's the political version of throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping that something sticks. Unfortunately for Fannie Willis, there's nothing sticking to the wall. But back to her disqualification. The fact that someone so deeply entrenched in political ambition was never allowed to run the show is laughable. She spent more time campaigning for her political agenda than prosecuting a case that's got all the substance of a wet paper towel. It's hard to take her seriously when you look at her track record. You don't need a man because you got a hand and running around with Nathan Wade and spending all this money and apparently stashing large sums of money in your house and this whole deal. I mean, it's just all so bogus. A few questionable public statements here. A few awkward social media posts there. Sure, those would never compromise the integrity of a case, right? Let's call it what it is, folks. Let's be savagely truthful in this moment. This case is a politically charged spectacle designed to drag out the current administration's vendetta against anyone who dares challenge its narrative. Willis's disqualification isn't just warranted, but it's long overdue. Now, I gotta let this story go because that's basically the end of it. Not basically, that is the end of it, but I really enjoyed this case. And now that we're seeing it come to an end, I begrudgingly let it go. I miss she brought a lot of joy in the political scene for me. I really thoroughly enjoyed reporting it. And, you know, we got to let the case go of the lady that was doing the bomb chicka bow bow in the prosecuting's office out of Fulton County. Bye-bye, Fannie Willis. Moving on. Let's talk about Trump and Trudeau and Canada and Mexico and tariffs, okay? President-elect Donald Trump of November 20, 2025, announced planned tariffs against Mexico and Canada. You've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but I'm letting you know that he has. And here's what you need to know about that plan, because he's been on Truth Social and he's been talking about it. He talks about everything on Truth Social, by the way. This is the most transparent president that we've ever seen in American history. He puts it all out there. There's no guesswork. We know what Donald Trump is thinking. We know what he thinks about what's being done or what's being said or any move, because he puts it all out there. It's wonderful. If we can't be literally with him to be able to poke him and touch his shoulder, we know what he's thinking because he puts it all out there. It's been great. On Truth Social, he said he would put the tariffs into motion on January 20 of 2025, the day that he is sworn in, and that the 25% tariffs are designed to coerce the two countries into stopping the flow of narcotics and illegal immigrants into this great U.S. of A. And I quote from Truth Social, "This tariff will remain in effect until such time as drugs, in particular fentanyl, and all illegal aliens stop this invasion of our country." Both Mexico and Canada have absolute right and power to easily solve this long simmering problem. We hereby demand that they use this power, and until such time they do, it is time for them to pay a very big price, end of quote, Donald J. Trump. Now, during his first term, Trump also leveraged the threat of tariffs to exact immigration concessions from Mexico. So, with that being said, there is a model for what might be expected this time around. Okay, if he says it, he will do it. We know that from his first presidency. Ah, Donald Trump. His bold proposal to make Canada the 51st state. Now that's the kind of brilliance we've come to expect from the man who's made America first a global catchphrase. Now imagine it. One more star on the flag. More maple syrup than any American could possibly consume in a lifetime, and a border wall between us and, well, the frozen tundra. Of course, what's the best part? No more confusing hawking talk at the UN. Think of the savings on healthcare costs, too,
since we could just about adopt Canada's system while still keeping the best bits of America, like, you know, freedom, apple pie, hot dogs, ice cream, right? Women shopping and getting diamonds. And a tax code that actually makes sense. But let's not get ahead of ourselves, okay? I'm not calling Canada greater than America, certainly not. I would never, ever utter anything like that. The idea of adding Canada to the Union is less about geography and more about sending a very specific, concerted message. The U.S. isn't afraid to think outside of the box and possibly annex a neighbor or two. That's the message we're trying to drive through here. Then there's the feud with Justin Trudeau, of course, who is really, really where the fun begins, okay? This is where it all begins here. This is where the fun is, right? Trump's rivalry with the Canadian prime minister was more than just the typical diplomatic squabble. It was a clash of egos, with Trump constantly reminding and winning, reminding Trudeau that he's the boss. He is the boss of North America. Now, who could forget then that Trump publicly dissed Trudeau's for not being a nice guy, as if being nice was a character flaw, right? That's a qualm on Trump. I love it. He's just that bold enough to do that. Meanwhile, Trudeau's delicate handling of issues like trade and tariffs gave Trump all the ammunition he needed. Well, we'll remind him who's in charge, right? This is what it's really, truly all about, all jokes aside. This is about letting everyone know on the globe that America is back, okay? We are on our way back, and you need to step up and do what you can as a country to contribute to world peace, right? And we're just gonna hold countries accountable. It's like a sibling rivalry, except instead of playing Monopoly, they're negotiating global trade deals and winning or losing millions of dollars, depending on which side you're on. And to be honest with you, I always want to be on the Trump side of things. But Trump's agenda is so much bigger than a spat with our friendly neighbors to the north. It's about holding every country accountable. Canada, Mexico, NATO nations, you name it. All those countries that have freeloaded off America's military, our economic and diplomatic might for far too long. Trump was there to remind them that the era of let's all just be friends is over. It's time for a new world order where America doesn't get stuck picking up the tab for everyone else's issues, everyone else's party. If NATO countries can pony up for their defense, then maybe, just maybe, America shouldn't be the first to jump in with our military, right? They're having issues. Why is it always us the first to jump off the board and go in and help and put on the super cape and the S on the chest and use the radar? You know, that's an end. We need to carry the weight of the world when it's clear that many of our allies are more than happy to let us. We just need to make that, change. Trump's reestablishment of America as the global stronghold wasn't about being the bad guy. It wasn't about that. It was about putting America's interests back where they belong, at the very top. Let's face it, the world has gotten cozy on the couch of American power for decades while we footed the bill for every single one. Everyone, from trade deals to military commitments, it's time for everyone to pay their fair share. Yes, I use that term, to pay their fair share, because in this case, it's relevant and it's pertinent and it's appropriate. Trump's approach wasn't about world domination. It was about tough love, okay? This needs to be a reciprocated friendship. Maybe the world would learn a thing or two if we stopped being the big brother and started being the boss. And that's what America is right now. We need to get back into boss mode for a while. And then once we get everyone to acquiesce and step up and do their part and pay their fair share, maybe then we can kind of slip down to friendship. But right now we need to be back on top as boss. After all, someone's got to keep the global order from turning into a free-for-all, and Trump has no qualms about stepping up to do it. Whether that means considering Canada as the 51st state or simply telling NATO this, it's time to start pulling your weight. Now, I'm using a sarcastic tone, savages, for this because it's just funny to laugh at, right? It's just amazing. It's wonderful to watch Trump in order.
It's wonderful to watch him operate, and I have so much to look forward to, as you do, when he's back in. But in all seriousness, Donald Trump's approach to international relations emphasizes holding all NATO nations accountable for their commitments to mutual defense and fair trade and honoring the terms of their alliances with the United States. Now, he recognized that America's global strength should not be taken for granted and that NATO countries must meet their obligations in order to ensure the security and stability of the global order. Trump sought to reassert America's leadership by demanding that all allies contribute their fair share, not only in defense spending, but in upholding the values of democracy and mutual protection. His stance was rooted in the belief that the U.S. must not bear the burden alone in defending the free world, and that peace and security could only be maintained through equitable partnerships and shared responsibility among democratic nations. And that is a savage truth. As a former Democrat, I've long said that the Obama administration was definitely the catalyst for my departure of the Democrat Party. Notice I said Democrat Party, not the Democratic Party. There is a difference. But yes, Donald, the Obama, I voted for him. I was super excited when he was in. I just thought he brought this amazing message and that he was the manifested promise of Martin Luther King when he said that I could see a Negro in office in less than 40 years being the president of the United States. I thought Obama was it. And then he flipped the script once he got in. Did not vote for him the second time. You know my story if you've been a loyalist. The Obama administration marked a significant turning point in America's politics. But for many, it also unveiled deeper societal divisions and policies that stifle the nation's potential. I truly, truly believe that. While the election of Barack Obama was a historic moment celebrated for breaking racial barriers, the reality of his presidency underscored the limitations of symbolism without substantive unity. We did not see unity. In fact, we saw much more division. And that divide was very, very wide, okay? From the outset, from the very beginning, from the get-go, the Obama administration's rhetoric often emphasized systemic racism and societal inequities, which also deepened racial tensions. Okay, it was all about pitting one racial group against another and the classes. It was all about the divide and you're being angry with me and I'm more special than you, right? That's what it was all about. He had policies. He presented policies such as the Department of Justice's interventions in local policing, right? Seen in cases like Ferguson, right? The entire lie, the fiasco, and all of the drama surrounded by the Ferguson case. Cases like that fueled narratives of division rather than fostering constructive dialogue. And at the same time, his administration's economic policies, if you want to call it that, if you can call it that, if you can say that and not laugh, including heightened regulations and the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, were perceived by many as hindering small businesses, stifling entrepreneurship, and centralizing government power at the expense of individual freedom and economic prosperity. Okay. In all, the Obama administration stifled Americans. It stifled economic prosperity. It stifled individual prosperity. His all-around presidency for both terms was all around bad, but it put America last. It started this whole notion of America last. Now, as a Black American who grew up in a family staunchly supportive of the President Obama, my departure from the Democrat Party was both personal and ideological, right? I just simply wanted to vote my values, right? For many, though, Obama's presidency was a source of pride, a moment to celebrate shared heritage and the progress of civil rights. That's how my family members saw him. That's how they saw his presidency. It's what it represented. Yet my realization that his administration's policy often prioritized political posturing over genuine solutions was a source of tension, especially between myself and my family. I came to see how his leadership encouraged identity politics and divisive rhetoric, ultimately alienating communities instead of unifying them. My decision to align with conservative values was met with resistance and accusations of betrayal to my race, right? Betrayal to my family, betrayal to my culture, betrayal to humanity, especially those of color. But it was grounded in my belief in policies that promote self-reliance, personal responsibility, economic freedom, and unity under shared American ideals. This journey underscored the importance of critical thinking, right? To be able to think for myself and make my own decisions and to be able to research and draw conclusions and make the most educated decision possible for me, myself as an individual. And the courage to challenge narratives that prioritize optics over progress. Now, you probably say, Cicely, what's this all about? What are you talking about? So why do I bring this up? Because it's a savage truth and proven by Obama alumni. Out of the mouths of babes, out of the mouths of Obamians, they proved that my notion was right and justified in my skepticism for Barack Obama and his administration and his entire presidency, his entire presence in the Democrat Party right now, today, as we speak. Here's the savage truth. Barack Obama was not good for America. He was not good for Americans. Now, I have a video, okay? I have a video that's going to literally prove without a shadow of a doubt, and it's almost a slap in the face. It's kind of a real kick in the gut, right? A slap in the face, a kick in the teeth, because it is just so very frank, overt, and just so offensive that it's almost hard to believe your ears when you hear this. And for those of you who are viewing, you actually get to watch it, okay? But we talk about Obamacare. And here's the truth about it. Here's the truth about Obamacare. It put in place guaranteed coverage and community rating. Community rating, meaning everyone would be charged the same rate. Now, I know people hear that and say, yay, that's great, but really it's not, okay? Guaranteed coverage, meaning that everyone has the right and everyone will get some kind of healthcare coverage, right? But here's the thing. If you're healthy and you work out 7 days a week like me, you're never sick, you don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't do drugs, you get plenty of sleep, I have to pay the same rate as someone who lives the exact opposite lifestyle. Now, this isn't to smear the unhealthy, okay? For those people who are unhealthy or have issues, if you suffer from health issues, you by all means should address them, okay? But there is a time when in the 80s and 90s, people actually loved their healthcare coverage. They knew what it was. They got to choose it. They really liked it. But I think it's logical to say that someone like me should not be paying the same rate as someone who has a terminal illness or the person who smokes, eats processed foods constantly. They smoke, they drink heavily and abuse drugs, who suffer for or from them maybe who are, you know, innocently affected by health issues, like someone who has respiratory or muscle or joint issues. So here's the deal. To all you young 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, millennials who were just super excited to vote for Obamacare, right? A young, healthy 20-year-old should not be paying the same rate as someone who is 55 and has joint pain and respiratory issues, or a 60-year-old who has arthritis for working 30 years on the assembly line, for example. That's simple and fair. And Dems think we're too stupid to know this or to figure it out, okay? All the young people who voted for Obamacare, like I said, it was designed to make you pay for the arthritis, for the COPD, and the joint issues for the middle age and seniors. That's the savage truth. Look it up. Now, here's a guy right here. Here's that video I'm going to play for you, for those of you who are watching and for those of you who are listening. Here's a guy named Gruber, who was one of the economists who assisted in designing Obamacare. One of the architects. Now here he is speaking about how they passed off the mandate, which was a tax, by the way, forcing us to pay, but we were too stupid to to do our homework. This is the thinking of the left out loud, literally out of their mouths, that caused me to realize and run away like my undies were on fire soaked in gasoline. Now talk about transparent financing. This is what he's talking about. Listen to this.
Transparent financing, and let's have transparent financing, also transparent spending. I mean, this bill was written in a tortured way to make sure CBO did not score the mandate as taxes. If CBO scored the mandate as taxes, the bill dies. Okay, so it's written to do that. In terms of risk-rated subsidies, if you had a law which said healthy people are gonna pay in, it made explicit that healthy people pay in and sick people get money, it would not have passed. Okay, just like the people, lack of transparency is a huge political advantage. And basically, you know, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical to getting the thing to pass. And, you know, it's the second best argument. Look, I wish Mark was right, we can make it all transparent, but I'd rather have this law than not. So it's kind of like his reporter story. You know, yeah, there's things I wish I could change, but I'd rather have this law than not.
Okay, that video, that replay says it all. It sums it up for me totally. It sums up my realization of the Democrat Party's view of me as a Black American. Now, he's not specifically just talking about Black Americans, but what I'm saying to you that as a Black American, I started realizing when I was doing my research and drawing data and actually reading and paying attention and listening to those veterans that I was volunteering for, that something wasn't adding up. I left the Democrat Party because I realized that they have long taken my loyalty for granted, assuming I would blindly follow their agenda without question. Now, as a Black American, I was told that voting Democrat was a given, a non-negotiable part of my identity. Yet, as I began to examine the party's policies and rhetoric, I noticed a troubling pattern. They seemed to believe that I and others in my community were incapable of thinking critically, researching facts, or forming our own opinions. Instead of empowering us and recognizing that we actually don't need you to empower us altogether, they perpetuated narratives of dependency, offering handouts rather than opportunities for growth and self-reliance. You heard the saying, it's almost a political cliche, giving you a handout instead of a hand up. It became clear that their agenda wasn't about lifting people up, but about maintaining control through division and fear. Breaking away from the Democrat Party was not easy, especially when confronted with accusations of betrayal. And the one I hate the most is accusations of self-loathing, you know, this self-hate. You know, you can't possibly be a Black Republican unless you hate yourself. However, my choice to embrace conservative values was rooted in a desire for true empowerment and accountability. I simply wanted to be accountable to myself. I wanted to be accountable to my country. I wanted to pay homage to those who laid the groundwork for this great American experiment. The Republican Party respects my ability to think for myself. In fact, they encourage it. They insist on it, right? They don't talk down to me. They value my individual liberty and champions policies that prioritizes personal responsibility, economic opportunity, and strong families. By leaving behind the patronizing assumptions of the Democrat Party, I reclaimed my agency and found a political home that believes in the potential of all Americans, regardless of race, to achieve greatness through determination and hard work. It's just that simple. So to quote the great Maya Angelou, when you listen to this tape and you listen to this guy, okay, when someone tells you who they are, believe them. I did just that. And I haven't turned back, and I won't turn back. And looking at the red map of November 5th, 70% of Americans are feeling the exact same way, and I'm super excited about it. Look at that map. Look at it. This is a great Savage Truth to end on today, looking at that map. Please like, share, subscribe, and leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And remember, as always, to be bold, be strong, be faithful, be true. Till next time, I'm Cicely.
The Savage Truth with Cicely Davis is a production of Front Page Magazine and the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.